A decade of dissident discourse. It can only be millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial X. This is now the seventh night, and there are four interviews coming up. In 2 hours it'll be Newsfist, and then The Ferryman's Toll, and then Isaac Young. But first, I'm here with Alexander Adams, who is a British artist. Alexander, would you like to introduce yourself to the audience?
Oh, thank you for inviting me on. First, I have to say that actually when I was talking to my wife this time last year, when we were talking about what we wanted to do the next year, one of the things she mentioned was she said, I want you to be on Millennial 2024. And I was really chuffed when I got your invitation. So thank you for that. And that was unsolicited as well. So I didn't ask to appear. You invited me on. So that was quite a nod to me. So thank you. So my name's Alexander Adams. I'm a British artist and writer. I've been making art since the 1990s. You can find my art on alexanderadams.art if you want to see. So if you want to sort of scroll through some pictures while I'm talking, that's the place to do it. I also have a Substack, so I'm Alexander Adams Artist. Get this up. So it's Alexander Adams. It's Alexander Adams Art on Substack. Those are the two main platforms. So I live in England. I've lived in different places. At the moment, I live in England, in the north of England. And I've written quite a few articles. I've written several books. One of them is published with Imperium Press, and that is Blood, Soil, Paint, which is about the connections between Romanticism, nationalism, and identity. And that was published, 2 years ago. And so that's what I do.
Just on the face of it, immediately I have to ask, how do you fit into the British art scene? Because something like just what you just said there, I think a lot of, from my experience of the British art world, which is scant compared to yours, but from my experience, most people would run a mile from something like Blood, Soil and Paint. Like that, the very concept would scare the hell out of them. I mean, I'm not going to go on at length about my experience of art college, the London art world. I'll just put the question to you. What kind of relationship do you have with the art world at large?
It's pretty tangential at the moment. It used to be closer. So I used to have, when I started out, so maybe this is a chance for me to explain where I came from. So I studied art at Goldsmiths in the mid-1990s, which I think was, you were in London studying in the 1990s as well, I think, weren't you?
No, not until the very early, like 2002 is when I moved to London.
Oh, okay, right. So, yeah, so I'm, well, as you can tell from the grayness of my beard, I'm a little bit older than most. So I thought he was just better preserved than I was. So I studied at Goldsmiths in London in the mid-1990s, and when I went in there, it was just the tail end of the YBAs, the Young British Artists, so with Damien Hirst and Sarah Lucas and Tracy Emin and so forth. And, you know, there were still sort of technicians who were knocking around who'd worked on Damien Hirst's show, and they'd known him as a student because Damien Hirst went to Goldsmiths. And so there was a little bit of buzz and excitement. So we were kind of like half trying to grab a hold of his coattails and join the YBAs. And half of us were like, no, man, we're all about painting, man. We're authentic painters. We don't need any of that shark stuff. So there was sort of like a big divide between people who were, you know, who felt ambivalent about that when Damien Hirst was getting big. And I was a pretty serious painter when I was at college. And it was quite tough to be a painter. They'd ask you a lot of questions. They'd really put you through the ringer. And I think quite rightly, because it forced us to think strongly about what we wanted to do as artists, what we wanted to avoid, why we were artists rather than anything else. Because when you went into the art department, you didn't have to choose painting or sculpture or photography. You could do anything you wanted, which was kind of quite a frightening thing for youngsters who went in there and weren't clear about themselves. It was fantastically freeing and liberating, but it was also meant that you were paralyzed by choice. You could literally do anything. You could go in and do a performance. You could stand on a chair and recite gobbledygook, or you could paint like an old master, and anything in between. So that was pretty tough on the psychology of youngsters. So I came out quite a convinced painter. I swallowed some lies at college. Well, not so much lies, but myths. The myths of, an artist being romantic and not being materialistic. And, if you chase the market, you'd end up like, you'd end up like Jeff Koons. You'd sort of sell out. And I think maybe the whole point of Jeff Koons is that he's a sellout, but I didn't want to do that. And it made me feel uncomfortable. But I went in with an ambivalent attitude towards the art world. So you had galleries, you had commercial galleries, and you could put on your own exhibitions. You'd sort of hire out or find a derelict venue, and you'd just put on a show. I remember we did a show in an old house. It was an old vicarage that one of the students I was at college with used as a studio. He had one room in there. It was an old vicarage, and I think it was still owned by the vicar or the Church of England. And we put up this show of like sort of weird painting, abstract painting, and silly installations and sort of projections. And someone set up a sort of a mermaid in the bath because it was just like a regular house. And we had a couple of nude photocopied figures, life-size figures on the walls. And apparently the vicar came around during this show and was most unimpressed. And I think he either pulled down those photocopies or they got covered over. So anyway, we had all this weird stuff going on. And then there was also the commercial stuff. You could go through the galleries, you could sell, you could have exhibitions, and they would have connections with other galleries abroad. And you worked your way through that sort of thing. And then you got to the stage of having shows in arts centres. And then you got to the stage of having shows in international exhibitions and then museums. And there was quite a steady progress involved. And this was something that I got into while also telling myself that, I wasn't really materialistic at all. And then suddenly I found out how materialistic I was when a number of things happened and I kind of went off the boil. So there was personal stuff and then there was stuff to do with the situation in general. And I ended up being semi-detached from the art world and I had to think, after a period of about 10 years or so, I had to think very hard about what I wanted to do because it was clear that I couldn't do things in the old way. I couldn't do things in the way that you were taught at college. The doors were not going to be opened. The avenues were not going to be the same. So
when was this? You said after 10 years you had to make a decision.
Okay, so I was working as an artist basically nonstop. Well, I've been working nonstop since 95, which was when I graduated. So, but around in I would say sort of around two. So I went to Berlin in 2007, and I was in Berlin. I think after a couple of years, after a year or two. So it was like about 2008, 2009, I entered a period when I didn't know quite what I was going to be doing because I'd hooked myself up to a gallery that wasn't really selling my art. I was loyal to the gallerist, but she wasn't really selling my art in any quantities. I couldn't live off that. I was stagnating and I kind of, my loyalty was to her and I felt like I couldn't leave the gallery. But it wasn't exactly, I hadn't kind of tied myself to a sinking ship, but I tied myself to a ship that was completely waterlogged and not going anywhere. And I ended up waterlogged too. So I had a period of stagnation in Berlin. Sorry, which unfortunately is a very nice place to stagnate, unfortunately.
Yeah, was that in Kreuzberg?
I was in Kreuzberg, and then I was in Prenzlauer Berg as well, which is the funky East German area.
I've visited that. But what I wanted to ask was, you said that the way that the art college had taught you to operate wasn't working anymore. Is that because of technological change, social change? Because it's often this way, that this is a sort of cliche, that the professors or the lecturers at art college or any college are accustomed, they've been trained in a way that worked 20 years before. 10 years later, it's completely obsolete. Was that the case here, or is that something different?
Yes, technology was moving on. I wasn't doing anything at all online at that stage in the early 2000s, and even through the 2010s. You know, like, I didn't even get like a Facebook account until like the late 2010s. So that was something that was happening. Also, I think, you know, we'd been sold this lie of meritocracy. We'd been told, well, so this is something that actually applied to my tutors. So they still believed it because it had worked for them. And that was basically, if you did good enough, if you went through enough exhibitions, if you sold to the right people, if you got noticed in the right places, you sold, you won prizes in exhibitions and you got that sort of thing, your work would enter museums. So your work, if you were good enough, you were a British artist, you were good enough, your work would end up in the Tate Gallery, which is for foreigners. I should explain that the Tate Gallery is the British Museum of National Art. It's also the British Museum of Modern and Contemporary Art. So under both criteria, my work should have been eligible. But I think now that I came to it, I was very slow in realizing this, but it was like, okay, although there's some of my work in museums, these doors are not going to open for me and they're not going to open for my colleagues. We have to make art as if it's destined for a museum that doesn't exist yet. The museum where this picture is going to hang, where it's going to change people's lives, it's going to excite them and enrage them and bore them, perhaps, is going to be a museum that has not been founded yet. It will derive from the collection of someone who's collecting now as a private individual. And that will turn into a museum at some stage, but that museum does not exist yet. And that is our future. And I think that it's wrong of us to fixate on the paths that have gone. It's easy to lament that sort of thing, but it's time to put that aside and start painting for ourselves, for each other, and for ourselves as artists.
Would you say that... the art world today, what kind of work do you think it is? And I don't want to fixate to dwell on this too long, but what kind of art do you think does fit into the art world of today and the galleries and the museums of today?
I would say it's either stuff that's politically useful, or the weird category I've noticed is is something I call amnesiac art. And it's basically art that has no characteristics at all. And it has no personal, it's got no aesthetic characteristics, it's got no personal characteristics. So you look at this stuff and it's like a plaster cast, or, you know, like a car that's been taken into the gallery and been decorated, or, you know, someone's cut a hole in the wall, or there's a stack of old magazines and then there's a light bulb on top or whatever, you know. And you look at it and, you know, you can read the label or not read the label, but the point is that you're not going to remember that half an hour later. It'll be out of your brain and you won't be able to remember it. You won't be able to remember the name of the artist. And it's kind of, this is like a, it's like a sort of, it's like a drug or some sort of, it's like a filler text, you know, like when you set out a document and you set out a book and you put in a filler text and, you know, if it's Latin. Yes, exactly. So if you don't speak Latin, you put in loads of Latin, so you recognize it as words, but you don't really understand what the words are unless you speak Latin. And it's like this. This is filling up a gallery, and it's a particular name of an artist, but the work you're actually seeing has no qualities at all. and it's designed not to have any qualities. You know, you could choose art, if you're a curator, you could choose art which was, you know, girl power, or, you know, Afrofuturism, or, you know, whatever. You know, you could take a stance and put something that's got, like, at least some memorable characteristics. But I think that actually works against it. I think what happens is people choose the artist, and it doesn't matter what the art is. So the art itself is kind of like interchangeable. You could change the labels with the name and the title, the name of the artist and the title, and you could swap around all the labels, and it wouldn't make any difference. And it wouldn't make any difference to anyone, not even the artist, not to the curators, not to the people who go there. The art is amnesiac art. It's not supposed to stay in your memory. It's very, very, very strange.
It certainly is. It's like, it's not even about, presumably those works sell, but I imagine they don't sell for anything, any large prices. So really it's about creating a collective culture of vacuity so that each exhibition is recognizably vacuous. And any crap will do. For that, and then scattered among that there might be some big name artist, and that's the stuff that's really to sell. And this is this other stuff, what you call amnesiac art, is just it's like the blood plasma that floats around, but it's got no character. Yeah. No real function.
Absolutely. I mean, it is very odd. I mean, the economics of art is very peculiar. It's the largest so-called grey market in the world, which means basically it's not discernible to an outsider what's going on. That stuff is getting traded for odd prices, sometimes inexplicably high, but also oddly low. And then, you know, some of this is to do with money laundering. We all know about that. But there's also things to do with, like, reducing your taxes. So what you do is you buy a picture, you engage in a campaign of sort of buying other works by that artist that raises the value of your work. Then what you do is you donate it to a museum. In America, that's tax deductible, and a lot of rich people do it, and they end up paying no tax at all, because they've essentially manipulated the market and find a way of evading tax. And so you've got weird stuff like that, and also you've got, like, free ports, where, like, for example, Geneva's got a free port. It's like an art place, and you basically it's a sort of high security warehouse, which only certain people have access to. And what happens is the art goes in there, and it can be parked in there, and it can be bought and sold. And the people who buy and sell this stuff actually don't see the art. It's like trading a piece of paper. But you know, if you looked at the paper, it would just be a bunch of numbers. So it's almost like crypto or something. And that's a really weird thing. So you've got works of art in sort of Geneva Freeport, and I think there's one in Singapore. There's a few scattered around the world, and there's some very, very odd things happening indeed. But that has to be said. I mean, that's largely high end stuff. That's not the sort of younger artists or lesser known people.
Yeah, it's like at least in part, art has become a method for storing value, storing wealth, and it could be just any other asset, really. So, and of course, a big part of that is, as you say, tax avoidance, and also money laundering.
Tax reduction, I think it's called by the accountants.
Right. Okay.
Tax avoidance is correct. Tax evasion is illegal. Tax avoidance is perfectly legal.
Yes, I believe that's the distinction. So obviously that's a large, and I think people, ordinary people who aren't, you know, laymen who aren't versed in this kind of thing, they see these works and would draw the conclusion that we just drew there, that this is a scam of some kind, because it clearly does not make sense. It clearly does not have beauty or truth or value. It's something else. So basically a big scam in a lot of ways. But I would ask you, what do you think, and this is a huge question, but in your opinion, what should art be?
art should be something truthful. It should also be something enduring. I think also it's not necessarily the way you want to live. It's not necessarily describing an ideal society. So this art could be quite uncomfortable, and it could take many forms. It could be representational, it could be abstract. I think that what you're trying to do when you're making a picture, certainly when I'm trying to make a picture, I'm trying to find something that really excites and engages me and feels like the truth. And you're having, and you have difficulty explaining it any other way. You can only get to the end product by making it yourself. So sometimes you're dealing with an image and you don't know why that you're dealing with that image. So some people can explain what they mean in words. Some people can conceptualize what they need in words. I need to do it through pictures because I'm not, even though I'm a writer, I'm not an especially verbal person. I'm not, and words never strike me as powerfully as images. So when I'm trying to make a picture, so for example, I've been doing some square paintings of nudes, and what I wanted to do is to make some square paintings that were truthful about the nude, and they would be, some of them would be flattering, some of them would be ugly, some of them would be obscene, some of them would be kind of titillating, some of them would be like a Greek statue. And these would be based on photographs that I found. And when you're doing those things, you know that you're just compelled by this image, and you have to try and set aside how people are going to react to them. You have to say to yourself, I'm painting for myself. I'm painting for someone who's going to see this at some stage in the future. And it may be someone who sees it after my lifetime, because some of these pictures you think, well, these are never going to be exhibited. These are never going to be sold. You know, who's going to buy this sort of thing? And you have to think to yourself, that's not my concern. My concern is making something that's strong and powerful and truthful. And it might be shocking. It might be shocking for other people. It might be shocking for me. I might find it horrible and I might want to describe it to you. And you take what you want from it, but I can't make it for you. I have to make it for myself.
So it's something that doesn't necessarily have a constant meaning. It might be subjective.
Yes. So, you're going to find some people saying, oh, William, I thought that picture was very beautiful. Or someone's going to say, well, about the same picture, they're going to say, well, that's a bit grotesque. Some people are going to say, well, as I have said in an interview, I think a little while back, I said, you know, I thought maybe I was holding up a mirror to the world, and what you would see in that mirror was what you think of the contemporary world. Because the nudes that I'm doing, the square nudes that I was doing, they embodied something of the contemporary world. So they were set in just the average bedroom with, you know, bric-a-brac on the floor and a full cigarette, you know, an ashtray by the side and an old mobile phone. And it would be a bit scuzzy, but it would also be your life. It would also be the lives of, or at least, you know, the life that you led as a student, or you knew a place like that. And it would have a powerful resonance for you because it seemed both noble, because, for example, you might look at the figure and think, oh, that's just like a classical statue or a Degas nude or like a Rodin bronze. And yet, at the same time, it was set in what was someone's living room or it's a student bedsit. And so you'd have this weird friction between what you've found familiar and what was new, but it would be something in a surprising combination.
Well, yeah, and I know the kind of thing that you mean, and it is quite jarring and affecting to see something that has those elements of, let's say, classical art, but is in the modern world. And sometimes you can see a photo there is, I can't think of any off the top of my head, but you can see a photo that seems to be framed in some way, and the elements are arranged in a certain way that strikes you as something from another time, and yet it's clearly of this age, and it is a strange feeling. And then, as you say, the meditation on, you used the word scuzzy, just, I would say, the sort of mundane, maybe vulgar aspects of modern life, but making it seem, elevating it, you know, making it seem something eternal, something that can be contemplated upon, rather than just looked away from.
Yeah, I was thinking, well, actually, what really excites me in photography is not art photography. It's not the sort of photography that you probably go and see in a gallery wall or would get published in a big hardback book. It'd be something like, it would be like a snapshot, or it might be what someone took of their friends just across the room or something. That sometimes it's much more powerful when something's unfocused, or, you know, something's badly cropped, or, you know, it's a Dutch angle. And these things can be kind of, they're exciting because they remind you that this is a real person in a real place, and they exist the way that you've photographed things, the way that you've captured things just on your smartphone or something. Yeah,
that is another aspect. When something is, as it were, not badly captured, like haphazardly captured, that adds to the realism of it for sure. And again, it's sort of jarring because we're so accustomed to things being very finessed. Well, so I wanted to get that from you, your own conception of what art is and should be, because one of the things that certainly at art college, when I was at Chelsea, was that was left completely open to each student. I mean, we were never told, here's what art is, and here's what art should be, here's what you should be aspiring to. Do you think that's the right approach or not? I mean, I think there should be some guidance, because I think that when you're 18, you really don't know anything. But I can understand also, because you alluded earlier that it was completely open at Goldsmiths. Where do you stand on this matter? Do you think that this is something that should be, there should be a doctrine to it as such, or so to speak, or do you think it should be completely open for each young artist to decide for themselves what art is?
I think that we have to make art for ourselves. And that means, I know that a lot of people feel that, well, the modern world is degraded and people are dehumanized and turned into commodities and okay.
I don't know what happened there.
Okay.
You just glitched.
Okay.
Sorry, everyone. Were saying you don't think you can ennoble people with paintings of knights on horses.
No, I think that we have to make art that's true to ourselves and true to what we see around us. That doesn't mean we are simply recording. What we're doing is going through a process of recording and transforming and suggesting and melding this from the art of the past that exists, and using the materials that we need to use. New materials are going to come up, and we've got to be able to use them. I know that craft has a tradition inherently ties you to something truthful, because you can't do certain things with certain materials. And the ancient craftsmen knew that, and that's why they always used particular stones for certain places in a building or certain sculptures. They knew this because they had worked this stone before. They knew what the tools were going to do. They knew what the elements were going to do. They knew that you couldn't put a softer stone, you know, below a harder stone or a heavier stone or whatever. So they knew that. But we can't rely on those old rules, because we're going to have new materials coming up, and we should be free to be able to use those materials, and we should use those in the language that's true to us. So when we look at the art of, you know, the late 19th century, the sort of the realists, when they got the paintings of peasant girls in smocks, you know, carrying apples and so forth, that was considered at the time not traditional. That was considered rather bold, because it was set outside of the studio. It was lit naturalistically. Sometimes it was actually painted en plein air. It was painted outside, literally outside. People would set up the canvas in the orchard and paint the model standing outside. And this was considered an odd practice. This was something that was invented by, well, the Impressionists in the 1860s. But prior to then, everything was done in the studio. So when people now look at the traditional painters, the naturalist painters, and they think of them as traditional, they weren't traditional at all. They were considered quite sort of cutting edge. And again, you know, people think of, well, Leonardo da Vinci, traditional artist. Well, you know, he was a revolutionary artist. He was one of the first artists in Italy to paint in oil paints rather than tempera. And so that's what gave his paintings a particularly smooth quality, a sort of lifelike quality, a sort of soft, breathy quality. And that was an innovation. So, you know, what exactly are you thinking about traditional art? Because all of this art, when it was new, if it was any good, was breaking some new ground. And what do you want to do now as an artist? As an artist, do you want to say, oh, you know, my idea of progress stops at, you know, 1900s. There's lots of people who sort of huff and puff and say, you know, 1900, that's a cutoff. Well, you know, I don't think that's suitable for artists in a vital culture, in a living culture. You have to be able to decide your own methods and your own materials and your own style. Otherwise, it's not going to be a complete expression of who you are.
It's not going to be authentic. You're going to be imitating something from the past.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt there. I wanted to summarize.
No,
that.
No. I finished. I'd done my thing.
What I would say, I would counter that a bit by saying, yes, I understand what you're saying, that basically all art, there isn't a moment when it was frozen and it's always been evolving. But I think there is the opposite extreme is where, or the extreme of that is where there is no tradition, there is no structure, there is no, what would be the word, induction of a young artist into his craft and into the intellectual framework of art history. So, and then you end up with, well, my generation, we were at art college, we were taught virtually nothing of art history or technique. So I got this extreme. And so did all the others on my in my year, and I'm sure it's got even worse since then. I mean, that's 22 years ago. So to me, I understand. I do absolutely think innovation, advance, evolution is necessary, partly because artists are very inquisitive, curious people, but also because it is only if they have that freedom that they are able to be honest. But the other side of that is, honesty is not something that comes naturally to a lot of people, especially young people. So that's one thing. I think people almost have to be taught how to be honest, at least, if not by their teachers, then by the hard knocks of life. But the other thing is that art, I think there's a danger if there is no framework, no grounding in art history and theory, then it's just going to be nonsense. So then you've got this tussle in the young artist between trying to be honest or not, maybe he doesn't realize the importance of that, and also just following impulses untutored way. So those are the dangers, I would say, if you don't induct young artists into a tradition.
Absolutely. Okay, so I completely agree with you. If people go to my Substack and have a look at it, you will find on it an article called I'm No Old Master and Nor Are You. And that was basically me talking about my experience. So basically, I went into art college. As I said, I was like a diehard painter. But when I went in, I was like doing... The first place I wanted to go to was the etching studio. They actually had a fantastic etching studio up on the top floor, and it had giant sort of ceilings, very high ceilings, huge windows, beautiful light. And the art department was always trying to get rid of these old fuddy-duddy etching presses and stuff. They wanted to move in the computers. The tutors wanted it as their common room or something. They wanted to get rid of all these pesky machines with, you know, students with ink up to their elbows and stuff, and, you know, sort of bits of cloth hanging from clotheslines and the acid baths and stuff. And it's like, no, man, no, this is it. And I went there and I was absolutely, it was the best place, you know, ever. I was just like, I was in heaven. So I was making all these etchings, and I was basically saying, you know, like, oh, I was saying to myself, oh, I'm going to be the new Rembrandt. I'm going to be the new Titian, you know. And I was there, going up there, and I was doing my little etchings, and they weren't very good. And because I was modeling myself on the old masters, and I was thinking of myself as the old master, the future old master. I mean, obviously, I wasn't as good as Titian. I knew I wasn't as good as Titian. I was thinking, I want to be as good as Rembrandt. You know, I want to do those really dark, rich etchings with all the heavy inking. So you got loads of atmosphere, and I was producing nonsense because I was so caught up in the craft, and I was so caught up in the mystique of the old masters that I didn't realize, well, these old masters, when they were working, they didn't think of themselves as old masters. They were doing something new. They were making art that was new and exciting. They were breaking new ground. They were inventing new techniques. They were testing out new materials. I mean, Leonardo was notorious for mucking around with materials. That's why The Last Supper is such a mess, is because he was working in a technique, and it, even by the time he'd finished the painting, which took him about 3 or 4 years, it was already peeling off the walls because he was messing around with the techniques. And the problem is that once you get caught up in the mindset of an old master, you think, maybe if I lived in Chester, for example, which was an old city that was near where I grew up, if I lived in Chester, you know, with all their half sort of wooden beamed houses and the Victorian arcades and stuff, like if I squint properly and I can stand, you know, out of the light of the streetlights, out of the view of the streetlights, I can pretend I live in 1600s, you know, and I can go home and make etchings and stuff. Well, you know, but who's going to be interested in someone who pretends to be 300 years out of date? I mean, it's a nonsense. You're deceiving yourself. For one, you're wasting your own time. Don't do it. If you're really passionate about art, make something that means something to people around you now. Don't start playing. Don't start seeing yourself as, you know, hanging next to an old master. Or, you know,
it's so. Playing a role. I mean, it's fitting into our character. And I think this is something, again, it's part of being young. You know, it's part of being a young, especially a young man. Although I suppose it's probably true in other ways for women as well. But being a young man, you aspire to this or that. Having a role model and thinking that you could emulate that. And in some ways you can, but it's in very roundabout ways. If you try to directly emulate it, you're just faking. You're just, as I say, playing a role. And it's not authentic. I mean, I saw this. And I was, and it happened, it was, I did it as well. I mean, I have to admit that. It's, you know, a character like Withnell, for example. I think a lot of, I definitely wanted to be like Withnell. I thought it was cool. And I think a lot of people, I can think of several characters that I knew at art college. I was first at Carlisle, then at Chelsea. And I can think of quite a few characters who clearly aspired to that, you know, to be the burnt out very articulate, very witty, very well-read, very well-educated. But the thing is, nobody was that anymore. Mm. That's the problem. Nobody is as posh as that anymore. Nobody is as well-read as he is anymore. So it's all of, and of course, nobody is as acerbic, you know, all of that kind of thing. But you're talking, obviously, he's a fictional character. You're talking about emulating real people. But the point is that it still is relevant, because I think as a young man, you don't know who you are, even if you think you do, even if you tell yourself you do. You really don't. And so obviously you're going to glom on to this or that person that you admire, that you think made it, someone you're impressed by. So I think that's a sort of natural process. And perhaps part of the process of growing up beyond that in your early and mid-20s is realizing you're not that. You're not that thing that you want to emulate. You're not that thing that you find exciting and admirable. But yeah, Nonetheless, you are something else and not worthless.
And what's going to happen is someone at some later stages, if you're any good, they're going to be excited by you as you were when you really found yourself. They're going to be excited by the things that you did later on, which are going to be more truthful to you. But I understand completely about being inducted into a tradition. So, for example, like I did a day course on wood engraving recently. So I make, at the moment, I make liner cut prints of mainly of authors. I'm working on two big new ones, which are going to be a bit different. You know, I've been doing all these liner cuts of authors, which people can see at Imperium Press. So if you go to Imperium Press, there's a page which has merchandise, which includes posters and prints. And so I was making these liner cuts and I was like, well, you know, they're pretty good, but, you know, I've got to stretch myself a bit more. And people around me were telling me, you know, come on, you can step up your game a bit. You can do a bit more than this. And I'd had this exciting encounter with wood engravings, which I already knew, but they're basically, it's like the reverse etchings. So etchings are very, very fine drawings in, basically you end up with a fine drawing, which is in black lines on white paper. A wood engraving is different, where that's how you have a block and you're basically carving little scratches in it. So you're drawing in white. So you end up with a block of black with white lines on it. So it's the opposite of etching. So I did a course on wood engraving and it was fantastic to be inducted into this sort of this old craft by someone who really knew his stuff. And he would say, oh, you know, we use these kinds of woods. We use these tools. We got these particular gouges. You know, you've got to make sure that you do this. And, you know, he'll open a book and he'll show you a wood engraving from 200 years ago. And he said, you know, this was the master. You know, Berwick was the master. He did lots of pictures of wildlife, especially birds. So he's the master. You know, like you can see here, he's doing one of those marks, and he must have had one of these tools. And he holds up the tool, and you know, you try it for yourself. And this is a fantastic introduction into the tradition. Now, with any material and any technique, you can use it in any way you want. So you can do. A wood engraving of someone speaking in a mobile phone or a mobile phone display or anything you want. You can do it. That it's literally the limit of what you can do with these tools and your imagination. So being part of that tradition, you're being inducted into it. And then you must think of, if you're any good at all, you want to extend it. You don't just want to do what Berwick was doing 300 years ago. You want to go beyond. You want to go beyond, and you want people 200 years from now looking back at you and saying, that's the man. That's who did it first. That's what you want. But yes, it requires that understanding of the material. It understand of what inks you can use, of what type of wood grain is best for this. And that's a really exciting thing, because you're being taught the limits. So for example, if you're on the political right, what you're doing is you're not saying, I can change everything. You're saying, I can learn about where I am and who I am in the world by looking at what the limits are. You know, I can't change my skin color. I can't really I might be able to change my citizenship, but I can't really change my nationality. I can't change the way I was brought up. I can't change, within reason, you can't really change your religion. I mean, you can stop practicing it. You might try and convert, but basically you have to start living with who you are. And part of that is like working in stone and knowing you can't carve a certain way because you're going to crack the block. You have to hold the chisel at this angle. If you don't hold it at this angle, you're going to break the block. You're going to destroy the work. So part of learning that tradition is understanding the world as it is, rather than having a utopian mindset and saying, oh, I can change the world. Well, you might be able to make some changes in the world, but you're not going to be able to change the world. Understand who you are and understand your materials.
That's fascinating. In a related thing, a few months ago, I started watching wood turning videos on YouTube. And this is a whole thing. There's a whole subculture on YouTube of people. Do you know what wood turning is? Yeah, because people use different names for it. I'll just explain. It's when, for the audience, it's when someone's got a block of wood spinning on a thing, and then they chip away at it and sort of carve it and so on. And very obviously, the result is very circular. And it's funny. I mean, I don't know if you would categorize it as art exactly, but it does have that element of craftsmanship about it, where it's you're seeing the relationship between the man and the material, the thing, and the raw material, and from that he creates the thing, and it's fascinating to watch. It's fascinating to watch because you see him getting to know the material, getting to know the unique piece of wood, and this is something I didn't really know before. Every piece of wood is unique. Every piece of wood has its own knots and bits, characteristics. Every type of wood is unique. You have to treat it in a different way. It's got its own characteristics. So I really enjoyed watching this because it stimulated that aspect of me, which I don't know if you would call it an artist or not, but it's definitely that thing about a relationship between the creator and the material and the creation. It's very therapeutic. It's sort of contemplative to watch this. But I also, as I say, it does feel like something kind of sacred. What would you say about that?
Yes, I think because it's a part of learning about yourself and learning about the world. I was reading about Heidegger, and he was talking about like thrownness. You're thrown into the world before you start to understand anything. You're placed in the world and you don't know anything, and everything that's around you has already pre-existed. It already exists before you, and you're having to relate yourself, your existence, to the existence of things that already existed. And the fascinating thing, of course, is that you're looking at this wood and you're coming to understand its unique characteristics, which is what you do when you're actually using it, or even just watching a video about it, which I agree is fantastically absorbing. And you get really into the minutiae of, yeah, you've got a certain type of grain, you know, this kind of wood's going to hold this kind of mark, but you can't do that can't use that kind of tool there because you're going to get, you know, going to get it some sort of splintering or something, or it's going to, you know, it's going to gouge, or you're going to, like with this one, you're going to put on wax, but you know, you've got to be really careful about what sort of wax, and you're going to apply this one cold and apply this one hot. And it's really fast. I mean, like, if you have an artistic bent at all, if you're interested in making objects and handling objects, and I think, you know, I'm always much more interested in objects and images than I am in ideas or people. So like I'm a natural artist, whereas I'm not a natural writer. Anyway, I'm kind of going off on a tangent.
No, but it is relevant and it's interesting because this was always my problem. I couldn't work out whether I was an artist or not. I still don't actually know. I don't think I am. I think it doesn't quite fit me. But I think words are probably my domain, even though as I often find myself, I can't think of the word. You know, it's happening more and more now. I think I need to read more. But yeah, the here's one thing I wanted to ask. I mean, we could talk about this more. I feel like we're only just touching on scratching the surface here, but it's there is so much to it. I would just say to the viewers, go and watch some wood turning videos on YouTube. I think you'll understand what we're getting at. It's this, you see, as Alexander has illustrated, there's a lot to know. There's a lot of skill involved, not just talent, but skill that's acquired, knowledge that's acquired in doing this right. So you see the guy examining the piece of wood, wondering what could I do with this unique bit that it plays out and he creates something from it. So yeah, it's very nice. Now here's something I'd like to ask you about, because you've I think this might have I'm sure you'll have thought about this, and it's you've several times you've alluded to the desire to be remembered, the desire to be. And that the arrogance of the young man in thinking, well, I could be like that. I could be like the old masters. I could become that. I could be as remembered. What would you say about the relationship between ego and art, and well, being an artist? Because obviously, there's the stereotype of the artist who's who remains like that, who's very vain and full of himself and arrogant. But I also think that that's kind of, yeah, you kind of have to be like that when you're young. And maybe this isn't just relevant to art. Maybe it goes for any field that a young man might enter. But I think with art, because it's so personal, this is amplified. What would you say? Because, okay, just one last thing. I also think that part of becoming a good creator is getting your ego. It's there. It's a propellant. It drives you into it at the start, gives you the arrogance to do it, to get started. But part of becoming a good artist, a good creator, is learning to subsume your ego into something greater and less toxic, let's say. Well, that's what I would say. What would you say about this?
Well, that's a whole huge area. So remind me if I miss out an area. Okay, so ego, yeah. I think when you're very young, when you start out, when you're making stuff, you don't have an ego. You're just kind of like, oh, you know, I want to draw spaceships. I want to draw cowboys. I want to draw robots, you know. And, you know, and if you've got a book full of robot pictures, you know, you start doing your own versions. You start tracing and then you start doing your own versions. And then, you know, you start setting them in landscapes and stuff like that. And you want to make them super realistic. And you get frustrated when you can't do the shading right. And you're kind of lost in what you're doing. You don't notice, you know, you don't notice anything. You're just completely absorbed in it. And then later on, once you get to the stage of going to art college, you become self-aware and you think of yourself as like, well, you know, I want to be an artist. I want the title of an artist, so I have to do an art degree. It's not necessarily the case, but, you know, that's the conventional route. And so you do start having ideals. You start thinking about, oh, you know, I really want to buy like this artist or that artist. And that's true. But then you've got to break through. Well, no. And also you've got to have that ambition. You've got to have kind of, put it crassly, you could have a big dick about it if you want to be an artist. If you get to the end of your art degree after 3 or 4 years and you're still sane, you haven't like gone off your head with magic mushrooms and, you know, too much alcohol and arrogance and, or you haven't been destroyed by your lack of direction by going down different routes, you know, chasing after, you know, performance and video and stuff like that. If you get to the end of that and you've still got your head screwed on, if you want to go out into the world, you've got to have a huge amount of arrogance. You've got to be able to go into a gallery and as I did, you have to go into a gallery and you say, look, here's my work. In the old days, you'd go in with a portfolio. You'd have a black portfolio, zip portfolio, and you'd have your little plastic envelope, plastic sheets inside, and you'd have pages full of, your pictures, photographs of your pictures, physical photographs, and you'd have some text next to it. And you had to, you know, you had to go in there and be tough and say, you know, I'm worth looking at. I went to this college. I've been in this show. Or, you know, hey, I was speaking to this guy and, you know, he recommended you. He said, you're the best gallery. You can handle this stuff. You're, you know, you know where it's at, et cetera, et cetera. You've got to develop that line. You've got to develop a thick skin. But at some stage, you've also got to get beyond that, get beyond thinking of yourself as an artist. And this is something that I struggled with, and I know it's what a lot of people have struggled with who have been through the art system, is that they are so wedded to the idea of being an artist that they're scared to change. They're scared to make stuff that contradicts themselves. So what's going to happen is, if you're making art honestly, you're going to, just as you do as a man, or you do as a political being in the world, you encounter new information, you see that you made a mistake, and you have to be honest about, you have to take that next step, and you say, like, I know better now. I'm not that person anymore. And also being an artist means you have to take a step forward and say, I'm not the artist I was then. Now, it's not necessarily a mistake. You're saying, you know, you're not necessarily disavowing the stuff you did when you were 25, when you're 30. But what you're having to say is, I don't do that work anymore. That was work that I did when I had a particular concern, a particular interest. I'm a different kind of person now, and I have to produce different kind of art. And so, yeah, you do have to be able to get over your ego, but you have to have enough of your ego left to drive you to have an ambition. So it's a tricky balance.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? It's not an easy question to answer. It's not something that you can easily summarize, because, yeah, ego is powerful, and it can be toxic, but you need it. But you need to overcome it, but you still need to have some of it. So it's quite difficult. Yeah. Okay. And then another thing, you've talked a lot about physical materials. And I've said myself about the relationship, and there's something that I miss, actually, because I work digitally all the time, and I always have done. And I do, maybe this is why the wood turning videos got to me, because I thought, God, it would be nice to, for it to be physical. But anyway, here's the question. What would you say about, do you have any experience of working digitally, or is all of your work physical? And do you think that in this age, highly technological, do you think that the physical is being neglected? Do you think that something is being lost? Go for it. Digital versus physical art.
Okay, so, yeah, okay, the first thing I'm thinking of is something super practical, and it's really dull, and it's basically, where are you going to store your art? So, okay, if you're going digital, you've got your stuff on your hard drive, but guys, you've got to check your hard drives, because they die, they expire. If you're not transferring the data onto something fresh, if you're not putting it in the cloud, don't rely on the cloud, by the way, don't rely on the cloud, but, you know, if you're not got multiple sources for it, you're going to lose it. That's happened with photographs that I've taken. And no, I don't do digital art, to answer your question. But I'd have a whole load of photographs that I took digitally. And, you know, one computer died, one computer got stolen, and I didn't back it up. Or I put it on a memory stick, and the memory stick got lost. I put stuff on hard drives. I don't put it on hard drives anymore. After losing about 3 or 4 hard drives, I'm like, screw you, I'm going on something solid state. But even then, they also degrade, so you've got to be careful about that. So yeah, you've got the problem of digital degradation, but if you're making physical things, where are you going to keep them? What are you going to do when you've got, I mean, I'll tell you, I've got, you know, over 1,000 paintings, I got, you know, 5,000 drawings and prints. If they're small paintings, if they're paintings on paper, well, you're doing okay. But mine are not. Mine are canvases. Some of my canvases are big. And those canvases are on stretchers, wooden stretchers, and some of them weigh, you know, quite a few pounds, you know, maybe up to sort of 5, 10, 15 kilos. You know, they're taking up physical space. They're fragile. they're prone to damp, they're prone to getting cracked, they're prone to yellowing if they're not exposed to UV light. So what are you going to do with your work? I mean, like, if you're, you know, if you're an altruistic sort of chap, you're going to be giving them away to your friends, but you're, in which case you're not going to have any sort of career because you're not going to make any money from it. No dealer's going to touch you. If you're giving away stuff for free, no dealer's going to touch you because, you know, who's going to pay for a painting when they can get it for free if they just know the artist? So you've got two sides on that. Now, what you're asking is also not even what do you do about the physical stuff, but what about the qualities of art? Is physical art being left behind? And I would say, I'd say no. I'd say that there is an interest in physical art just simply because it's not digital, because our whole lives are spent now digitally. We read books online, we watch videos online. Many of us don't have DVDs. I would say, you know, hang on to your DVDs if you can, because, you know, there's censorship and there's withdrawal of services, and lots of people have got online libraries, and then, oops, suddenly they haven't. Terms and contracts, you never actually owned anything. That this was just, you're just leasing it, you know? And you should have known that when you signed when you forked over your, you know, $5,000, $10,000 for all that stuff, you know? Hey, you didn't read the small print. You don't actually own any of this. You're just borrowing it. So, yeah, anyway, so a big subject, but I would say yes. Also, the rise of AI is going to mean that handcrafted stuff, and I know there's such a thing as digital printing, but handcrafted stuff is going to have a certain degree of cachet, and it's got a certain degree of authenticity. And I think that is going to live on because, you know, I'm finding that when people buy my liner cut prints, you've got a flat plate of liner, tile of liner, you're cutting it with your gouge, you're getting some ink on a roller and you're rolling it over the thing. You're putting this in a big press, specialist press, sheet of paper on it very carefully. Don't wiggle it around. Yeah. Running it through the press, running it out, running it back out. And you've got a physical object, and that can go wrong. And your plate is not, and your plate is going to degrade. You can only get, you know, 100, 150 good impressions out of one plate because it gets degraded. So all of my stuff is limited to about 50 or 60 copies, each signed, each numbered. And you can't do that digitally because it's all very well signing a digital print and saying, oh, there's only 50 copies of it, until the next time you stick your memory stick in and print out another 50 copies. But if you're doing it physically with a lino tile, the lino tile gets crushed by the weight of going through the press because it has to be under high pressure. It gets worn away at the edges. It gets, every time you clean it, you're eroding little edges and stuff. So the actual tangible physicality of making a print in an old-fashioned way, even though you might be using an electric press, I get my stuff printed professionally by someone who went to art school, who's an expert printer. They ink things perfectly. They know how to use the machinery perfectly. They know the perfect qualities of the paper. They know if you use damp paper or dry paper. And these are going through a professional. It's not just a question of me sitting down, clicking onto, digital JPEG, whatever, and printing press, and then out of my Canon or out of my Epson printer, I've got a special thing, but I've put a number on it, so now it's really special. It's really limited, guys. Honestly, I wouldn't reprint it. There's something very different about the process, and I think that's what's exciting about, like, wood turning, for example. Like you, as you said, the piece of wood is unique. That plate of lino, you couldn't cut it the same twice, and it's not going to last for more than 50. You know, about 50 impressions. So, yeah.
All right. Yeah, this is... when I was at art college, it was... Digital was definitely... I would guess that it was at its peak around then. 2002 to 2008, I would imagine, was when people were really enamored by it. Actually, we had a lecture by Brian Eno, And he, at that time, was... Well, there was also Jem Finer from the Pogues. He was doing similar stuff as well. He was doing something called Long Player, and it was... He was doing programming. And Brian Eno did this lecture where he was talking about his stuff, and it was algorithms that he'd written to generate random abstract imagery. Kind of similar in a way. I do similar stuff now for Millennial and my various projects. It's, a lot of it is generated by code, oddly enough. But he was calling it art. And I always had a problem with that, you know, because there's not enough of a relationship. There's not enough intimacy there between him and the thing he's created. It's, I don't know. I don't like calling it art. I mean, he has no idea what that algorithm is going to generate tomorrow or next week. It's random. So I don't know. I didn't like that. But anyway, the point is that I think at that point, this was probably peaking. And I think since then, the novelty and the newness of digital has probably worn off. And I think people realize, especially now with AI and 3D printing, that we're losing something because there should be some sort of relationship that took place here. So when you see a physical artwork, ideally, it was made by human hands, and it was a creator who toiled over it, or at least exerted himself here, at least gave something of himself to create this thing. Otherwise, it just feels silly and sort of meaningless. But you know, that's I guess you could separate art from craft there, but. Even then, even in crafts, I think it's much nicer when, and I do think that people have a lasting a nostalgia for this stuff that is never going to fade away. We're always going to think, oh, wouldn't it be nicer if we lived like we used to? Because the more technology takes over, the more it just flushes the meaning out of things. So yeah, I mean, I think I have a fairly typical attitude to this, in that I think technology should just be a tool. It's a very banal conclusion.
Well, well, absolutely, and you can't end up letting the tool rule you. You know, you have to use it wisely. And I think, you know, I don't know if people are still doing NFTs, but I mean, you know, I used to get emails about it. You know, like, we'd love to use your unique work for an NFT, a non-fungible token, you know, basically. Oh, well, people know what an NFT is. I don't think anyone, I never did it. I don't know anyone else who did it, but yeah, I think that's kind of died. I think people have seen that it was kind of like a speculation bubble, and then it stopped. As far as I know, I mean, I haven't pursued that.
An NFT can be anything. It could actually be a physical object, as far as I know, but the certificate is a digital cryptographic thing. That's my understanding of it. I did start, and I've got one this year. I've got one each year for Millennial, but it's a thing that's unique to, you know, there's only one of them each year. So that's something that I'm going to continue for the foreseeable future, because it seems to work. People seem to like that this thing happens, so I'll continue doing it. But there's
no, no, good for you. I'm happy about people making the most out of these things, and I think that there is an interesting relationship between something that is unique and a work of art, because, you know, what's special to a work of art is also the fact that it's not entirely replicable. Apart from the prints, they are, but you know, But a painting or a drawing, it's not replicable, and so I think it's fair to think of it in terms of like as a unique a unique sequence, a unique digital sequence of numbers. So there is an overlap.
Yeah, there is. Okay, there were a couple of super chats. Hold on a second. Well, Dharma Initiate asks, what do you think about AI art? Is it just a fad, or will it have lasting effects? Have you seen it affect anyone in your sphere? We've touched on this, but why don't you take it away?
it's very good at doing the simple stuff okay. So if you type in, like, you give it a few pointers, it will produce something initially quite striking, you know, because it basically it does a lot of work. It fills a page. It's quite detailed. And if you're using it, for example, to illustrate an article, weirdly enough, it doesn't seem to work so well with memes. You know, you'd think that this would be a surefire thing for producing good memes, but I don't know. We've seen so many of them. It seems to sort of hollow them out. It's like the MS Paint thing is still king. I don't know why, but is it art? I would say not. I would say, although you might have a human being directing it, I think there's not quite enough direct involvement, and there is more involvement of things that are outside of your control, like the algorithm and it's what it's been primed on. So those things are too out of the control of the artist to properly call it art. But I could be talked out of that position by someone knowledgeable.
Well, I agree, and this is the thing. This is the factor that there just isn't enough involvement. The artist isn't toiling enough. It's not that in the end result does not have enough of him in it. It's and that's why I wouldn't consider it art, but I would say that it could evolve into an art form. Because or an art method, if it became fine tunable, very, very, very fine tunable, so then the person using it would be like a film director, who's giving instructions, very precise instructions, and many of them, to various crew members, and they're carrying out his instructions. But as it is just now, it's like a director saying, "Make a film in this genre." And then it just goes off and does it. You wouldn't call him a director. That would be absurd. And in the same way, I wouldn't call an AI artist an artist for the same reason. There has to be far, far more involvement. But that is limited for now by the technology itself. There's no way to interact with it at that level, at that granularity. So yeah,
there were some aesthetic theoreticians who said, like, you know, it had to be an expression of the Godhead. It had to be an expression of something divine. Even if it was imperfect, it was an expression of divinity, because human beings were made in the image of God. So therefore, anything that man does is actually an extension of God's will. And so that's why you have the holy sort of triangle of aesthetics, which is truth, beauty, and goodness, and those are all come from a divine origin. By their definition, if there is no human being involved, substantially involved in the creation of a work of art, the old aesthetic philosophers would say, well, this is not art because it does not involve a person closely enough.
Yeah, and I would completely agree with them. That's exactly my attitude. I don't really know of a counter argument, unless you're going to say that, well, art doesn't have to be an expression of a human being.
People talk about the sublime experience, and the sublime experience could be a work of art, but it also could be, for example, Kant talks about like the raging tumult which is coming down coming down a mountain, or, you know, like the drama of a storm, or a particularly beautiful rock formation. So these are something that verge, they have aesthetic qualities, they verge on the aesthetic experience, but they're not man-made. So there's an interesting overlap between the sublime, which might be human or it might be natural. And this is something that I know that Burke and Hume and Kant discussed at length. So but I would suggest that people go up and look up the sublime, because I've actually written a few articles and it comes up in the book I mentioned earlier. So you could find more there.
Okay. Okay, Vingul said, cheers to Mr. Adams for his work. I enjoyed Blood Soil Paint, and I learned much from it. Recommended for all listeners, and available from Imperium Press. Thank you, Vingul. Mr. Roboto gives a very generous super chat, and he said, did either of you hear about the $6 million banana art the Crypto Bros bought and ate? I don't think that type of farce does any favors for the art or crypto worlds.
I heard about that. Yeah, so this is Maurice Catalan, who is a much fated Italian trickster of art, who's been knocking around for 30 years and doesn't seem to be getting any better. His jokes don't seem to be getting any better. So he had a banana and it was taped to a wall and it was auctioned for £6 million. Now, as I understand it, when you get something that's perishable like that, and especially when you get like a conceptual work of art, what they're doing is they're selling the right for you to reproduce it. So for example, just the once. So when you buy a work of art like that at auction, they understand that the banana's going to rot, there's going to be nothing there, and the bit of tape is going to get all manky, and you're not going to be able to peel it off, and it'll lose its stick. So obviously, it's a conceptual joke. So when you're buying it, you're not buying anything physical, really. You're buying the right to put a banana on your wall with a bit of tape over it. And you can loan that idea to a guy in Geneva who's putting on an exhibition of conceptual art, and he will get his own bit of tape, and he will get his own banana. He'll select his own banana, and he'll put it up on the wall, and he'll say, you know, this is loaned from a private collection in Geneva or whatever.
That is hilarious. It's absurd and surreal. I don't know what to think about. I don't know what to say about that. It just feels like charlatanism.
Late stage capitalism, that's what it is.
Late stage charlatanism. All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Roboto, very much. And then Stephen says, have you ever been to the Mitchell Library in Glasgow? Magnificent. By the way, I will just interject here that Glasgow Art College was designed by Charles Rennie Mackintosh, and it burned down a couple of years ago. That's a horrible thing.
Burned down twice.
It's burned down twice, but the second time, I think they're going to restore it. But I know that the second time was really serious. But yeah, what a thing. So he says, have you ever been to the Mitchell Library in Glasgow? Magnificent building with great marble and Greek-style sculptures on the outside. I used to dog school as a kid and sit in the Mitchell Library. Even back then, I was humbled by it. You inherently get it. I'm not artistic, but you instinctively get it. Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I think, because as a child, you see this stuff and there's just... you can't articulate it. You can't describe it because you don't know what it is. You're not educated on it. And yet there is a sense of gravitas and seriousness about it. And this is something that I think classical sculpture, classical architecture bestows upon a thing. I had similar experiences myself. Alexander, the Mitchell Library in Glasgow.
I've not been to Glasgow. Someone very close to me has suggested that I go to Glasgow and spend some time in Glasgow visiting museums and bookshops and cafes and so on. And I would love to go and visit the Mitchell if I was up in Scotland. I have sadly never visited Scotland or Glasgow. So shame on me. I've travelled all over Europe, but you know, I have never been to Scotland. I'm sorry about that.
Oh, well, that's surprising. It's definitely something you should do, but before, it's a lovely place.
Before I die, come on, say it, because you're getting old now, Alex.
I pulled back from saying that because I didn't want to imply that you're old.
Well, I am. No. I am older than you, and I'm older than probably most of your viewers. So yeah.
But you're not old.
Thank you.
Yeah,
my hairline is old.
But yes, you should definitely visit Edinburgh and Glasgow. Glasgow has a lot going for it. I mean, people, you know, talk badly about it compared to Edinburgh, and I've done so because I'm just more familiar with Edinburgh. But yeah, Glasgow, it is a nice city in its own way, as each city is.
That's what you say about a girl who's not very attractive. Like, oh, she's just very nice in her own way.
In her own way.
Ooh, look, that's harsh. That's harsh, Rose.
It's even true of Aberdeen, right? Aberdeen is a pretty city in its own way. I think that a lot of people like Edinburgh, but Glasgow is, let's say, of an acquired taste. But I don't think it's an ugly city. It's just different. It's just different from Edinburgh. You got to remember, I'm coming from this Edinburgh centric perspective, so that's what I'm accustomed to. But yeah, Glasgow is a nice city, right? I want to be quite clear about this, because I've got nothing against Glasgow.
I can see the posters now. It's Glasgow Tourist Board. It's a nice city. Millennial woes.
It's not the endorsement they were looking for, but it's the one they need.
Yes, it's the endorsement that they got rather than the one that they might have hoped for. Yeah.
All right. Well, to end with, I'd like to ask you a serious question about your own experience of, because a lot of people won't be familiar with this kind of thing themselves. I'd like your account, your description of how it is, how it feels to get inspiration and then get started on a work, and the experience of creating something. Is that something that is quite mundane for you, or is it an exciting experience for you?
It varies. It can be a little bit mundane. So, for example, you might have a commission. So you're kind of like, you know, your parameters have already been set, and you're kind of like searching something out. You're sounding it out. Other times, you see a view, or you meet a person, and you know, oh, yeah, I've got that line. That's the line I want. Or you've got something really exciting, like just a contrast of tones, because I don't tend to work very much in color, so it's tones. So it's really, you know, got a beautiful gray, and then you've got a really strong black mark against a white mark. I mean, it sounds really primitive, but you know, these things are exciting. I mean, you can see a primitive sculpture, you know, like a cave sculpture, or you know, like, or a cave painting, and they're, you know, and it gives you a punch, you know, or like a Jackson Pollock painting. That's, you know, I mean, people like it or not, it creates a huge impact. And sometimes you get really excited by those things, and that is a real thrill when you know, well, I've got something here, and you think, well, no one else could have come up with that. No one else would have seen that. That's mine. That's mine. I'm having that. I'm marking that. I'm marking my territory. And you get a real kick out of being able to do that. And you know that it was unique and it never existed before, and that you've got it, you own it. And it's something really exciting. I know that, you know, a lot of the aesthetic theorists, they were talking about like inspiration coming from the muses, and when it really comes, it does come like it feels like, you know, something divine. You've been touched, you have been given, you've been blessed by an insight, you've been touched by the hand of God or the hand of the muse, and they visit only when you pray, and only when you've worked, only when you know your area. But then you open yourself up to the magic of something special, something divine, something completely outside of human control. And it's like a spark, and it comes, and you don't know whether it's going to come again. You can't predict it, but you just have to do the work and listen very carefully, be sensitive to it, and you can get that spark. So that's when it's good. It's really good.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I identify with it. I've had that experience. So yeah, well, that was very nice. Thank you very much. I enjoyed that. All right. Is there anything you'd like to say, Alexander, before we finish?
Yeah. First of all, thank you very much for asking me on. It was a great thrill. Like it was on my to-do list. It's on my hope, on my wish list for last Christmas, and I got this. So I'm very chuffed about that. If anyone wants to follow my work, they can see my art on alexanderadams.art. You can follow me on Substack, where I'm Alexander Adams. alexanderadamsart.substack.com, and I'm also exist on Twitter, and I'm Adams Artist on Twitter or X, and those are the main places to find me, and you can follow me there, and I sort of cross post everything, so if I'm doing anything, that's where you'll see it. And if you're excited by the art, you can also go to Imperium Press and have a look at the liner cuts that I've been talking about.
All right, excellent. Before we finish, I should say that I didn't mean to be negative about Glasgow, but someone has said, I'm stunned people prefer Edinburgh to Glasgow. Edinburgh is such a tacky, dirty, pompous city. Glasgow was the center of global trade in the 1800s. The Mitchell was financed by a billionaire tobacco baron as a gift to the city. Much better architecture and stonemasonry in Glasgow than Edinburgh. Look, I don't dispute a word of that. I've got nothing against Glasgow, right? So just to be clear, all I'm saying is I'm more familiar with Edinburgh. But nonetheless, thank you for that contribution. I don't want it to spoil a lovely stream about fine art. So, Alexander Adams, thank you for appearing on Millennial X.
Thank you.
All right. I will be back soon with Newsfist. I'll see you then.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial, but how about giving something back to your tireless host? Commemorating 10 years of Millennial, this unique animated vector graphic is available as an NFT for one lucky owner, and only one. The auction closes on the 30th. Make your bid today.